In their midst, I slipped past Father. After half an hour, we reached a cleared field where stands had been erected for giants and smaller peoples. A few humans had arrived and had seated themselves. I slipped behind a tall man where I would be well concealed. I was close to the aisle and in a good position to scrutinize the feet of new arrivals. The ladies had to lift their skirts as they climbed. At each step, a boot appeared or a slipper peeped out. I counted them off. Ordinary foot, ordinary, large, quite large. The benches were almost full. Father arrived and seated himself far from me. Ordinary foot, small, but not small enough. Ordinary, 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 very tiny. Very tiny. The two lady fairies, accompanied by a gentleman, who was surely a fairy too, squeezed into the row only two below mine. The gentleman was stoop-shouldered, and one of the ladies was fat, but the other satisfied every cherished idea of a fairy. Tall and graceful, with huge eyes, skin as unblemished as satin, lips as red as pomegranate seeds, and cheeks the color of early sunset. The stands were too crowded. I couldn't approach them, but I'd watch to make sure they didn't leave. The wedding began. The bride and groom came into the field, holding hands. She carried a sack, and he carried a hoe. Each wore trousers and a white smock. At the sight of them, a roar rose from the giant stands. Giants screeched, moaned, grunted, and hummed that the bride was beautiful, the groom was handsome, they would be healthy for long and forever. And this was the happiest day in anybody's memory. Aside from enormous smiles, the couple ignored them and began to plant a row of corn. He prepared the ground, and she dropped in seeds from her sack and covered them with moist earth. As they finished, clouds rolled in and a gentle rain fell, although the sky had been clear when the ceremony started. The giants spread their arms and tilted their heads to receive the drops. I looked down at the fairies. The two plain ones were smiling, but the beautiful one was rapturous. She seemed to be singing, and tears rolled down her cheeks. The giants pantomimed their lives together. They farmed and built a house and brought a series of older and older children from the audience into the imaginary home. And then more babies for grandchildren. It ended when they lay down in the grass to signify their deaths together. Then they sprang up. Benches were overturned as giants poured onto the field to hug them and exclaim over the ceremony. I stayed in my place, marveling. These giants were lucky to see their lives laid out so sweetly before them. Did the pantomime help? Did it stop ogres from eating you? Did it prevent droughts and floods? Did it keep you from dying before your children were grown? Except for the beautiful fairy and a number of giants, everyone started back to the house, including Father. I stayed to watch the fairy, hoping, praying, that she would reveal herself to be Lucinda. She pushed her way to the newlyweds through a crowd of relatives and well-wishers. In a few minutes, the giants drew away from her. The bride and groom clutched each other. Both were crying. Uaxi appeared to be pleading. She crouched before the fairy so that their faces were level, and her eyes never left the fairy. The fairy stroked Uaxi's arm sympathetically, but Uaxi flinched at the touch. Finally, the giants turned and walked slowly back to the house. The fairy watched them go, smiling blissfully. This had to be Lucinda. There was every sign of it. She had probably bestowed a gift on the newlyweds that was as gladly received as mine had been. "Lady!" I called, my heart pounding. She didn't hear me. As I spoke, she vanished, without even a puff of smoke or a shimmer in the air to mark her departure. Now I knew for certain she was Lucinda, the only fairy in the world who would disappear in plain view. Fool, I called myself. Idiot. I should have spoken to her the moment I suspected who she was. She could be in Iortha by now, or soaring over an ocean. I returned to the house and found that the giants had grown somber, although the small people were still merry. I wandered through the hall, munching on this and that, while watching out for Father. Where should I go next? How could I continue my quest? The other fairies might still be here, and might know where Lucinda had gone. Quickening my pace, I began to search, and in a few minutes I saw them, standing together and looking as sorrowful as the giants. When I had almost reached them, Lucinda materialized in their midst, still smiling. I pretended to be utterly absorbed in the problem of cracking a gigantic walnut I had taken from the banquet stool.
"I won't waste my breath telling you how wrong it is to disappear and reappear as you do," the gentleman fairy told Lucinda. "I hope you don't plan to do it again in the middle of this crowd."
"No, Cyril, how could I leave the scene of my greatest triumph?" Her voice was musical. I smelled lilacs.
"What horror did you visit on this poor couple?" he asked.
"No horror. A gift."
"What gift, then?"
the other lady fairy asked. "Ah, Claudia, I gave them companionship and felicitous union."
Cyril raised his eyebrows. "How did you accomplish that?"
"I gave them the gift of being together always. They can go nowhere without each other. Isn't it splendid?"
The walnut almost slipped from my hands. "It's frightful," Cyril said.
"What's wrong with it?"
Lucinda thrust her head forward defiantly.
"They'll hate each other within a month,"
Claudia answered. Lucinda laughed, a pretty tinkling sound.
"Oh, no, they won't. They'll love each other more than ever."
Cyril shook his head. "If they argue, and all loving couples argue, they'll never be alone to recollect themselves, to find ways to forgive each other."
"You know nothing about it. Not all couples argue, and these two won't. They're too much in love."
"Imagine he bites his nails and she doesn't like it," Claudia said. "Or she rocks back and forth when she talks and he doesn't like it. They will never have any respite from the quality they don't like. It will grow and grow until all he sees in her is rocking and all she sees in him is nail biting."
"My gift has nothing to do with nails and rocking. It has to do with the heart which loves to be near that which it loves."
I forgot my walnut and stared at the mad fairy.
"Visit again in a year," Cyril challenged. "You'll see what the heart loves."
"From now on, all giants will elope," Claudia said, "rather than risk a wedding with you as a guest." "I shall return, and I'll be right, and they'll thank..."
"What are you staring at? I mean you, wench!"
Lucinda whirled on me. Chapter 18.
"She is probably another supplicant," Cyril said, "come to beg you to take away a gift you gave her at birth."
"Don't turn this one into a squirrel. I can't bear to watch it."
Claudia grasped Lucinda's wrist.
"You can't know squirrels lead charming, contented lives. I'm sure she prefers to be a human maiden."
A squirrel? I had to keep her from making a squirrel of me.
"Abensu ik ubasu unuxi akuria?"
I said, wondering if she spoke Ayorthian. I had just told her I didn't understand Kyrian. Lucinda's expression softened.
"I'm sorry, my sweet," she answered in Ayorthian. "I asked why you were staring at me. You're so beautiful."
Let her think me simple.
"What a darling child. What's your name, dear?"
"El." This was Ella in Ayorthian.
"Beauty isn't important, El. Only what's in your heart is important. Do you understand that?"
"Yes. I'm sorry I stared."
"No need to be sorry, sweet child. You did nothing wrong."
Her smile was dazzling. "Thank you, lady," I curtsied.
"You may call me Lucinda," she lifted her chin. "They would not have me say so,"
she indicated Cyril and Claudia.
"But I am a fairy."
"A fairy? That's why you're so beautiful. My friends
are shopkeepers,"
Cyril said firmly, also in Ayorthian.
"We sell shoes."
"For tiny feet," Lucinda laughed.
"For children,"
Claudia amended. "Oh," I said, "I don't need shoes, but I need help, magical help. Can you help me, Lady Lucinda?
You don't need her help, Claudia said. You should leave her while you still may.
I'd be delighted to help you. You see, Claudia, they do need us. Tell me, Elle.
I want more metal, if you please, lady. Whatever anyone tells me to do, I do, whether I want to or not. I've always been this way, but I wish I weren't.
The maiden is naturally obedient, Cyril said. Isn't that one of your gifts? And she doesn't like it.
I knew how sweet you were the moment I saw you. Obedience is a marvelous gift, Elle. Sometimes I give that gift to little babies. I certainly won't take it away from you. Be happy to be blessed with such a lovely quality.
But I began, then stopped as Lucinda's order gripped me. My mood changed, and I smiled joyously. The curse had been turned into a blessing.
Thank you, lady, thank you, I said, almost forgetting to speak Iorthean. I kissed her hand. There, there, you don't have to thank me. You only needed to see it in the proper light. She patted my head. Now run along, Elle.
My first order in my new state. I was delighted to obey. I rushed off. I knew I was happy only because I'd been ordered to be, but the happiness was absolute. I still understood why I had always hated Lucinda's gift, but I was glad nonetheless. I imagined future commands, awful ones, ones that would kill me, and I glowed at the idea of obeying them. For the first time since Mother had died, I was free of fear. I would embrace whatever happened. I felt as light as a cloud. I decided to find Father. If anyone would have commands for me, he would. I found him outside Uax's house, climbing into his carriage. He turned when he heard my voice, and I received a shock. He was actually pleased to see me. I had never before seen him smile without guile.
Ella, my dear!
I didn't care if he was angry. I ran away from finishing school. He laughed.
I knew the lass had courage. And are you a lady now, or still a clumsy cook's helper?
How shall I show you?
Curtsy for me.
I swept him my finest.
Excellent.
All his cunning returned.
You are pretty enough. Foolish of me never to have thought of you. Get into the carriage, Eleanor. I trust you will not damage your gown this time.
Shouldn't we say goodbye to Uaxi? I asked, climbing in.
She won't miss us. She's too heartsore over a gift from a fairy, he frowned. They say three were here, and I never saw a hair of them.
The carriage began to move. I didn't care where we were headed.
You are just in time to put your training to use, Father said.
Only tell me what I must do. His eyebrows rose.
This is more transformation than I had hoped for.
He was silent for a long while. I began to feel drowsy.
I am a ruined man.
His voice startled me. What?
I sold an estate that didn't belong to me. The gnomes who bought it have found me out. When we reach Frel, I shall have to repay them, and it will take all I own. I shall have to sell our manor, our furniture, the carriage, and I shall have to sell you, in a manner of speaking. You must marry so that we can be rich again.
So that he could be rich again.
Yes, Father, gladly, when?
I understood the monstrousness of his plan, but nothing could lessen my joy at the prospect of obeying.
What did you say?
I said, yes, Father, gladly, when?
You ask when? Not to whom? You are so anxious to wed?
No, Father, only to do your bidding.
What did they do to you at that finishing school? No wonder you ran off.
When we reached our manor, Father stayed outside to speak with the coachman, while I hurried inside to find Mandy. She was scrubbing vegetables, and a parrot perched on her shoulder. She hugged me so tight I could barely breathe.
Ella! Ella, my sweet!
The parrot squawked in gnomic.
Chok cho, echachoed, the chok chok.
I wished she'd never stop squeezing me. I wished I could spend the rest of my life as a child, being slightly crushed by someone who loved me. Father spoke from the doorway.
I shall be away from home this evening. However, tomorrow we shall entertain, Elvish mushrooms will arrive from the market. They're a delicacy, Mandy. Serve them as a first course for Lady Eleanor and her guest.
What guest?
Mandy asked after Father left. My husband, perhaps. I'm so glad, Mandy.
She dropped the pot she'd been washing. It fell into the washtub, but rose back into her hands a moment later.
Your what?
The parrot squawked again.
Chalk?
Mandy had named him Chalk, after his favorite word, which was an exclamation in gnomic, meaning oh or oh my or even eek. In this case, I'm sure it meant eek.
My husband. Father has lost all his money. I must marry so he can be rich again.
This tops all, she stormed. What is he thinking about marrying off a chick like you? And why are you glad about it?
Not just glad, I couldn't find the right word. Ecstatic to do it, if it will please them both, my father and my new husband.
Mandy cupped my chin in her hand and examined my face.
What's happened to you, child?
I met Lucinda, and she made me happy to be obedient.
No, baby. No, honey.
Mandy blanched.
She didn't.
It's much better this way. I don't feel cursed anymore. Don't be sad, I smiled. See, I'm giving you an order. If you obeyed it, you'd be happy too.
She turned you from half-puppet to all-puppet. I'm supposed to be glad about that?
I didn't answer. While Mandy stood dumbstruck, I looked around the kitchen, greeting every familiar object. Finally, she muttered,
Lucinda's up to new tricks.
Then she spoke to me.
I'm starved. Are you ready for dinner, love?
We supped together in the kitchen. Only the two of us, and the parrot, because Father had dismissed the other servants.
He must like my cooking too much to get rid of me,
Mandy told me over cold chicken wings and warm bread. She spoke no more of my new obedience, but it must have been on her mind, because she changed toward me. She stopped being bossy. I suppose she wouldn't give Lucinda the satisfaction of using my new state. However, Lucinda wouldn't have known, and I was denied the joy of obeying. The next afternoon, we prepared the broth for a fish stew with wild onions, dinner for my guest. I was slicing the onions when a boy brought the mushrooms Father had promised. Their carton bore the label, Torlin Karoo. Karoo meant mushrooms, but I didn't know the meaning of Torlin. Examining the box, Mandy frowned.
Sweet, would you look up that Torlin word for me?
Torlin. Torlin. Noun. Justice. Fairness, I read in my dictionary. Torlin Karoo. Justice mushrooms induce feelings of liking and love in those who eat them, used in elvish courts of law to settle civil disputes.
I'll twirl and caroo him.
It doesn't matter, I said.
It matters to me.
Mandy yanked on her boots and flung her cloak over her shoulders.
I'll be back soon. Please keep the broth from coming to grief.
I stirred the soup and thought about our dinner guest. I would be glad to marry him, but would I be glad afterward? He might be cruel or dull-witted or mad. Father wouldn't concern himself with my happiness, only with his own. If he were terrible, Mandy could order me to be contented anyway. Or perhaps I could persuade my husband to issue the command. Chalk landed on my shoulder and pecked lightly at my ear.
Chalk? Jigumku? Azug?
Lovely. An order. I had to kiss him. I turned my head and managed to kiss a wing as he flew to perch on a high shelf.
Jumku azug, he squawked again.
I approached the shelf and extended my hand. The bird obligingly hopped on. I brought him close to my face, but before I could touch my lips to a feather, he flew away to the top of a window shutter. I ran for the chair so I could climb up to him, but as soon as I was high enough, he flew off. When Mandy returned half an hour later, I had a spoon for stirring the broth in one hand and a strainer for catching chalk in the other, and I was breathless from running from one to the other. The curse must have known I was trying to obey, because my complaints hadn't started. I wasn't dizzy or faint or in pain, but I was weeping. Chalk wouldn't let me obey and be happy.
Ella, what's afoot?
A wing.
"What's a wing?" I corrected, starting to laugh through my tears. "Chalk won't let me kiss him."
"Don't kiss the filthy creature," Mandy ordered, releasing me. "Jumku Azug."
"He did it again," I said.
"Don't kiss him."
"Watch etch de Gumku Azug," I told Chalk, hoping he'd adopt my addition. I repeated it. "Pwach etch de Jumkum Azug." He liked it.
"Pwach etch de Jumkum Azug."
Much better. The new version was, "Don't kiss me." I'd be delighted every time he said it. After we put the kitchen to rights, we began to replace the Torlin Karoo with innocent mushrooms. Maybe I should eat the elvish ones.
"I don't want you hoodwinked, even if you don't care."
Father came into the kitchen.
"How's our dinner faring?"
he asked genially. Then his face darkened.
"Why aren't you using my mushrooms, Mandy?"
She dropped a quick curtsy.
"I don't know these elvish ones, sir. Maybe they're not fine enough."
I didn't want her to be blamed. I told her to exchange them when she wasn't sure.
"I sent you to finishing school so you wouldn't be a cook's helper, Ella. Use the elvish mushrooms, Mandy."
Chapter 19. My guest's name was known to me. He was Edmund, Earl of Wallach, uncle of Hattie's friend Blossom, the uncle whose marriage she feared because it might cause her disinheritance. I suppose I should have been amused, but I was too lost in worry that the uncle would be as unpleasant as the niece. I waited for him in the study, a half-finished square of embroidery spread across my lap. I had barely seated myself when Father opened the door.
"This is my daughter, Eleanor," he said.
The Earl bowed. I stood and curtsied. He was older than Father, with shoulder-length curled gray hair. His face was as thin as a greyhound's, with a long nose above a drooping mustache. He had a hound's sad eyes, too, brown, with white showing above the lower lid, and bags of skin below. I sat again, and he bent over my handiwork.
"Your stitches are neat and so tiny. My mother made the smallest stitches, too. You could barely see them."
When he spoke, I saw teeth as small as a baby's, as though he'd never gotten a second set. I could picture the toddler Earl peeking into his mother's lap and flashing those wee pearls at her exquisite embroidery. When we married, I would try to imagine that he was almost as young as his teeth. Leaving my side, he turned eagerly to Father.
"You could not hold such a position as I heard you express yesterday, my friend," the Earl said. "I hope you will explain yourself more fully."
They were discussing punishments for bandits. The Earl thought they should be shown mercy. Father believed they should be treated harshly, put to death even, as an example.
"If a bandit came here and made off with these valuables..."
Father waved his hands at the things he was in the process of selling.
"I'd be unnatural if I weren't enraged, and unnatural if I didn't act on my rage."
"Perhaps you couldn't help being angry," the Earl answered,
"but you could certainly stop yourself from repaying one offense with another."
I agreed with the Earl, and thought of an argument tailor-made for Father. "Suppose the thief didn't steal outright," I said. "Suppose he robbed you through deception. Would that thief deserve the same punishment as a bandit?"
"A different case entirely," Father answered. "If I allowed a rogue to cheat me, I would deserve my fate. The knave would deserve some punishment, perhaps, but not a severe one. I would have been a gullible fool and not worthy of my wealth."
The Earl nodded at me.
"The cases are not so different," he said. "If an armed bandit made off with your possessions, you might be at fault for failing to protect your home. You might then also not be worthy of your wealth. Why should a robber sacrifice his life for your carelessness?"
"Your logic is irrefutable, although its foundation isn't sound,"
Father smiled.
"Two opponents are more than I can defend against. You have much in common with my daughter, Wallach. You are both soft-hearted."
Neatly done, Father. Now the Earl and I were a pair. Dinner was announced. Father led the way to the dining room, leaving the Earl to offer me his arm. The Torlin Karoo appeared in our first course, as a salad, accompanying chilled quail eggs.
"The mushrooms are elf-cultivated," Father said. "Our cook found them in the market, and I wanted to serve them to you, although, frankly, I detest fungi.
Try them, Ella.
The mushrooms were bland. Their only flavor came from the lemon and sage Mandy had sprinkled on them.
I'm sorry, Sir Peter, the Earl said. Mushrooms of every variety make me ill. I do enjoy quail eggs, however.
The Torlin Carew's effect was rapid. By the time Mandy had whisked away my plate, I was wondering why I thought the Earl resembled a hound when he was really quite handsome. I was liking Father, too. By the time we reached the soup course, I was calling the Earl Sweet Edmund in my thoughts and smiling at him after every spoonful. When the fish stew arrived, I suggested to Mandy that she give him an extra ladle. Father struggled not to laugh. Even without mushrooms, the Earl warmed to me.
"Your daughter is charming, Sir Peter," he said during dessert.
"I had no idea she'd grow up so well," he answered. "I must marry her off quickly, or spend all my days looking over her bow."
Back in the study after dinner, I drew my chair close to the Earl. Then I picked up my embroidery and tried to make my stitches so tiny that they were invisible. Edmund and Father were discussing King Gerald's campaign against the ogres. Father thought the king's knights weren't aggressive enough. The Earl believed them to be valiant and praiseworthy. Although I wanted to pay attention to my sewing, I couldn't. Every time the Earl or Father made a point, I nodded my agreement, even though they disagreed. Then I noticed that the room was chilly and settled back into my seat for warmth. "Perhaps we should build up the fire, Father. I should hate for our guests to catch cold."
"I've never seen Ella so solicitous," Father said, adding a log to the fire. "She seems enamored of you, Wallach."
"I am," I murmured.
"What did you say, dear?" Father asked.
"Why shouldn't he know how I felt? I wanted him to know." "I am enamored of him, Father," I said clearly, smiling at Sweet Edmund. He smiled back.
"This isn't the first time I've sampled Sir Peter's hospitality and his superior table, but you were never here before."
He leaned toward me in his chair.
"She was away at finishing school," Father said, "at Madame Edith's establishment in Gen."
"The time was ill spent," I said, "if it delayed our meeting." Father blushed.
"My niece Blossom is at that school. Were you friends?"
The Torlin Carew had no influence over my memory, but I hated to say anything that would cause Sweet Edmund pain. "She is several years my senior."
"Blossom is almost 18, I think. You can't be very much younger."
"I was 15 in September."
"You are a child!"
He drew back in his seat. I couldn't bear it. "Not such a child," I said. "Mother married when she was 16. If I were to die young as she did, I should like first to have lived and loved." The Earl leaned toward me again.
"You have a loving heart. I see that. More woman than child."
Father coughed and offered the Earl a brandy. Then he poured a small amount for me. Edmund touched his glass to mine.
"To the eagerness of youth," he said. "May it always get what it longs for."
When he left, he took my hand.
"Tonight I came to visit your father. May I return to see you?"
"You cannot come too soon," I said, "or too often." When Mandy came to kiss me goodnight, I told her every word the Earl had said after I ate the mushrooms. "Isn't he wonderful?" I asked, wanting her to share my happiness.
"He sounds nice enough," she said grudgingly. "Not like your father, the poisoner."
"But Father is wonderful, too," I protested.
"Yes, wonderful."
She slammed the door as she left. I fell asleep telling myself stories in which I was the heroine and Edmund the hero. But my last conscious idea was an image of Prince Char when he'd caught the bridle of Sir Stefan's horse. His face had been close to mine. Two curls had spilled onto his forehead. A few freckles dusted his nose. And his eyes said he was sorry for me to go. Mandy woke me when she had finished her work for the night. I was hard to wake. The Torlin Carew still had me in their grip.
"I've been pondering, sweet. Think back. Did Lucinda give you a new gift when she made you happy about being obedient?"
She didn't say. I closed my eyes and pictured our meeting. She said, "Obedience is a marvelous gift. Be happy to be blessed with such a lovely quality. Why?"
Ah, it wasn't a new gift, just an ordinary command. Don't be happy about being obedient, Ella. Be whatever you feel about it.
I was happy to obey.
No, I wasn't. The room spun. I began to sob from relief mixed with sadness. I had been a begging puppy and a delighted slave, yet I hadn't felt cursed since I met Lucinda. Now I did again. After Mandy left me, I fell back to sleep and slept late. When I woke, my head felt heavy enough to sink through the mattress. The mushrooms! I bolted up in bed, although my temples throbbed. Every moment of the evening before played in my memory. I pounded the pillow in rage at Father for making such a fool of me. I found a note on the table next to me.
"My dear Eleanor, you are a charming flirt. Wallach appeared at dawn to request my permission to declare his intentions to you."
I dropped the letter, afraid to read on. If Father wrote I must marry the Earl, I would have to do it. If he came home and told me, I'd have to as well. But before he arrived, I could act. Mandy would tell me the letter's contents without making them in order. I found her in the hen house, talking to the chickens.
"Up, Secchi!"
A hen hopped off its roost, and Mandy collected 3 eggs.
"Thank you."
She went on to the next hen.
"Up, Echo! I need only 1 from you."
To me she said,
"Do you fancy an omelette?"
I held the eggs while she read the letter.
"Sounds just like his lordship," she said when she finished, "but it's safe to read."
Father had rejected the Earl's suit. Upon close questioning, the Earl had confessed that most of his property had recently been consumed by fire. He wasn't rich enough for us. Poor Blossom. Her inheritance wouldn't be worth much, whether or not the Earl married. Father continued,
"I haven't time now to find another suitor, but never fear. I shall secure a rich husband for you yet. For now, however, my own neck will have to go into the noose instead of yours. There is a lady who will wed me, unless I miss my guess. I have gone to offer her my hand, and to tell her that my heart is already hers. If my suit is successful, I shall send for you so that you may become reacquainted with her."
Reacquainted?
"Spare her any tidings of our poverty, although I flatter myself that there is not a shred of greed in Dame Olga's affection for me. As an accepted suitor, or a disappointed lover, I shall see you soon. Until then, and always, your father."
Dame Olga? Hattie would be my sister!
Chapter 20 Dame Olga accepted Father's offer. In expressing her satisfaction at gaining a new daughter, she nearly suffocated me.
"My darling, you must call me Mum. Mum Olga sounds so cozy."
The wedding was to be in a week, as soon as arrangements could be made, and as soon as Hattie and Olive returned from finishing school.
"They won't go back after the wedding," Mum Olga said. "They have learned enough. We shall stay here together, and you must all endeavor to lighten my desolation when my husband is away."
Her eyes followed Father, who was crossing her parlor to gaze out the window.
"And who will lift my desolation?"
he asked, his back to her. A blush deepened the color in her rouged cheeks. She was besotted with him. He was all solicitude, all tender attention. She was kittenish, coy, and syrupy. I couldn't be with them for 5 minutes without wanting to scream. Fortunately, my presence was required very little. I was rarely invited to Mum Olga's residence, and Father kept her away from our manor, which was day by day being emptied to satisfy his debt. I cared little about the furniture, except for the fairy rug, which Mandy and I hid one afternoon when Father was with Mum Olga. We also rescued the best of Mother's gowns, because Mandy swore I would shoot up someday soon, and then they would fit me. But we didn't dare touch Mother's jewels. Father would have known if so much as a brass pin had been missing. Anyway, None of them equaled the necklace Hattie had taken from me. The week was quiet. I spent my days and nights mostly with Mandy. During the day, I helped her cook and clean. At night, I read from my fairy book, or we chatted by the kitchen fire. My only ventures outside were to the royal pastures to see Apple. I had hoped to meet Char there, but the grooms told me he was still chasing ogres. The first time I visited Apple was the day after I returned to Frel. He stood under a tree, his attention fixed on three brown leaves that clung to a low branch. As I watched, he reared back, lifted his head, and reached for a leaf just beyond his grasp. In the bunched muscles of his back legs, and the straining line from his hips to the tips of his fingers, he was splendid. If Agulon could have seen him, another pottery sculpture would have been born. I whistled. He whirled and stared at me. I held out a carrot and whistled again, a song about mermaids, Apple's distant cousins. When he saw the treat, he smiled and trotted to me, both hands extended. Soon, he let me pet his mane, and came when I whistled, although no food was in sight. It wasn't long before the sight of me inspired as much happiness as the carrot. I began to confide in him. His wide-eyed attention was an invitation, and his trick of cocking his head to one side while I spoke made me feel that every word was a revelation, although he understood none of it. Hattie hates me, and makes me do things, never mind why. Olive likes me, which is hardly an advantage. Mum Olga is odious. You and Mandy are the only ones who love me, and you're the only one who will never order me about. Apple watched my face, his sweet empty eyes staring into mine. His lips curled into a smile. The wedding was held in the old castle. Mum Olga wanted it to take place in our manor, but Father said the castle would be more romantic. Against such an argument, she had no weapons. When we arrived, Father went in straight away to see to details of the ceremony and of the masked ball that would follow. I slipped into the garden to visit the candle trees, which, devoid of their leaves, resembled rows of skeletal arms bent at the elbow. The day was cold. I passed the candles and marched up and down an avenue of elms, trying not to freeze. I even tied on my mask in a vain attempt to keep my nose warm. No matter how cold I felt, I was going to stay outside until several guests had arrived. My toes and fingers were numb before I deemed it safe to enter. As soon as I did, Hattie rushed at me, her new false tresses bouncing. "Ella, I've missed you so!" She was about to embrace me, and I warrant whisper a command in my ear. I stepped away. "If you speak to me at all today, Hattie," I hissed, "I'll snatch off your wig and pass it around to the guests. But not a word!" Taking off my cloak, I walked to the fire and remained there while the buzz of conversation grew behind me. There was nothing to tempt me to turn. The flames were more interesting than the talk. I wondered what made the air in front of the fire shimmer so. "Aren't you going to watch the wedding?" Olive knocked my arm. "Can I stay out here with you?" The hall was silent. I said, "Don't you want to see your mother wed?" I wanted to be there, to see the horrible event. "I don't care. I'd rather be with you." "I'm going in." She followed me, and we slipped into the last row of seats. Father and Mum Olga faced an alcove, in which stood High Chancellor Thomas, who had begun to marry them. His speech sounded familiar, because he'd used almost the same phrases at Mother's funeral. The audience probably could have recited along with him. I heard coughs. A lady ahead of me snored gently, and Olive was soon asleep as well. A man in our row pulled out a knife and cleaned his fingernails. Only one viewer was rapt, leaning forward in her seat, nodding at each trite sentiment, smiling while dabbing at wet eyes. I smelled lilacs. Lucinda! She mustn't see me! As the daughter of the groom, I could hardly keep up the pretense that I spoke only Iorthian. She would be livid that I fooled her. I put on my mask. I would leave in the confusion of congratulations when the ceremony ended. I watched her, ready to duck if she turned my way. As soon as Sir Thomas concluded, Lucinda leaped to her feet. "My friends," she rang out while advancing on Father and Mom Olga, "never have I been so moved by a ceremony."
Sir Thomas beamed.
"Not because of this man's endless droning," there were titters, "but because of the love that has united these two, who are no longer in their first youth."
"Madam," Mom Olga began.
Lucinda didn't hear her. "I am Lucinda, the fairy, and I am going to give you the most wondrous gift."
Mom Olga's voice changed from outrage to delight.
"A fairy gift, and everyone here to see. Oh, Sir P, how divine."
I should have been making my escape, but I stood frozen in place. Father bowed.
"You honor us."
"It's the loveliest gift. No one can say this one is harmful or foolish." She shook her head defiantly. "It's eternal love. As long as you live, you shall love each other."
Chapter 21. Father was open-mouthed in horror.
"It's so romantic, Sir P," Mom Olga sighed, entwining her arm in his.
His face changed, and he chucked her gently under the chin.
"If it pleases you, my dear, my life,"
he looked wondering.
"My love?"
Olive climbed over my feet, trumpeting, "A real fairy!" She pushed her way to Lucinda. Well-wishers crowded around Father and Mom Olga, but few were so foolhardy as Olive.
The fairy would soon be free to look about. I fled the room. It was too cold to hide outdoors. I decided to venture upstairs. The stair rail was an open spiral, perfect for sliding. I resisted a mad impulse to take a ride, into Lucinda's arms, no doubt. I heard her voice and ran up the stairs. On the landing, I opened a door and stepped into a dark corridor. Closing the door behind me, I sank down and leaned against it with my legs stretched out on marble tiles. Would Father be happier as a result of the gift? Had Lucinda finally given a present that would benefit its recipients? I tried to imagine their marriage. Would love blind Father to Mom Olga's shortcomings? There must have been footsteps, but I didn't hear them. The door opened behind me. I tumbled back and found myself staring up at... Char!
"Are you well?"
he asked anxiously, kneeling next to me. I sat up and grabbed his sleeve, scrambling back into the hallway and pulling him with me. I shut the door behind us. "I'm fine."
"Good," he stood up.
I think he was grinning, but he may have been scowling. The corridor was too dim to tell. How would he explain my behavior? Why would he think I was hiding?
"I thought you were still patrolling the border. I didn't notice you at the wedding."
"We returned this morning. I arrived here just in time to watch you dash up the stairs."
He paused, perhaps waiting for me to explain. I didn't, and he was too polite to ask.
"My father spent his boyhood here," he went on, "before the new palace was built. He says there's a secret passage somewhere. It's rumored to start in one of the rooms on this story."
"Where does it lead?"
"Supposedly to a tunnel under the moat. Father used to search for it."
"Shall we look?"
"Would you like to?"
He sounded eager.
"If you don't mind missing the ball."
"I'd love to miss the ball." I opened one of the doors in the corridor. Light flooded in, and I saw that Char couldn't have been scowling. He was smiling so happily that he reminded me of Apple. We were in a bedroom with an empty wardrobe and two large windows. We knocked on the walls, listening for a telltale hollow sound. We felt for hidden seams. We tested the floorboards, guessing at who might have used the passage and for what reasons.
"To warn Frel of danger," Char suggested.
"To escape a mad fairy."
"To flee punishment."
"To leave a boring cotillion."
"That was it," Char agreed.
But whatever the reason for flight, the means remain hidden. We investigated each room less thoroughly than the one before, until our search became a stroll. We moved along the corridor, opening doors and poking our heads in. If any feature seemed promising, we investigated further. I thought of a silly explanation for my presence upstairs. "You've guessed why I shut myself up here," I said.
I have no idea.
He opened a door. Nothing worth examining. To avoid temptation.
What temptation?
He grinned, anticipating a joke. He was used to me. I would have to labor to surprise him.
Can't you guess?
He shook his head.
The temptation to slide down the stair rail, of course.
He laughed, surprised after all.
And why were you lying down?
I wasn't lying down, I was sitting.
Pray tell why you were sitting.
To pretend I was sliding down the stair rail. He laughed again.
You should have done it. I would have caught you at the bottom.
The strains of an orchestra wafted up to us, a slow allemande. The corridor we were in ended in a back stair, surrounded by doors that opened on more corridors, all more or less alike.
If we're not careful, we'll go down this one again, Char said. They're all the same.
Hansel and Gretel had pebbles and breadcrumbs to show them the way. We have nothing.
We have more than they did. They were impoverished. There must be something.
He looked down at himself, then tugged on an ivory button on his doublet until it came off in his hand. A bit of striped silk undergarment peeked out. I watched in amazement as he placed the button on the tiles a foot within the hallway we had just left.
That will mark our progress,
he chuckled.
I'm destroying my dignity without sliding down anything.
After we investigated 6 corridors without finding the secret passage, and after all of Char's buttons were gone, we climbed the back staircase. It ended in an outdoor passage to a tower. We rushed across, facing into a bitter wind. The tower room had once been an indoor garden, with small trees and wooden pots. I perched on a stone bench. It was chilly, but we were out of the wind. "Do the king's gardeners come here?" I asked. "Are the trees dead?"
"I don't know."
Char was sitting at the bench.
"Stand up."
I obeyed, of course. He pushed at the seat with his foot, and it moved.
"This lifts off," he exclaimed.
"Probably only garden tools," I said, while we lifted it together. I was right, but not entirely. We found a spade, a pail, and a small rake, and cobwebs, and evidence of mice, although how they got in and out I couldn't tell, and a leather apron, and 2 things more. Char twitched the apron aside and found gloves and a pair of slippers. The gloves were stained and riddled with holes, but the slippers sparkled as though newly made. Char lifted them out carefully.
I think they're made of glass.
Here.
He meant for me to take them both, but I didn't understand. I only reached for one, and the other fell. In the moment before the crash, I mourned the loss of such a beautiful thing. But there was no crash. The slipper didn't break. I picked it up and tapped on it. The sound was of a fingernail on glass.
Try them on.
They fit exactly. I held my feet out for Char to see.
Stand up.
They'll crack for certain if I do. I could barely stay seated because of the command.
Perhaps not.
I stood. I took a step. The slippers bent with me. I turned to Char in wonder. Then I was aware again of the sounds of the orchestra far below. I took a gliding step. I twirled. He bowed.
The young lady must not dance alone.
I had danced only at school with other pupils or our mistresses for partners. He put his hand on my waist, and my heart began to pound, a rougher rhythm than the music. I held my skirt. Our free hands met. His felt warm and comforting, and unsettling and bewildering all at once. Then we were off, Char naming each dance. A gavotte, a slow saraband, a courant, an allemande. We danced as long as the orchestra played. Once, between dances, he asked if I wanted to return to the celebration.
Won't they be looking for you?
Perhaps. Hattie and Olive would wonder where I was. Father and Mom Olga wouldn't care. But I couldn't go back. Lucinda might still be there. Do you want to?
No, I only came to see you,
he added.
To be sure you arrived home safely.
Quite safely. Sir Stefan guarded me well, and the giants took excellent care of me.
Did you catch more ogres?
Sa, susfing mun sisibus.
Yes, and they were delicious. I laughed. His accent was atrocious. He shrugged ruefully.
They laughed too, and never listened to me. Bertram was the best. They obeyed him half the time.
The music started again. A stately pavane. We could still talk while performing the steps. A fairy gave my father and my new mother an unusual gift. I described it. What do you think of such a present?
I shouldn't like to be under a spell to love someone.
Thinking of Father's scheme to marry me off, I said, Sometimes people are forced into wedlock. If they must marry, perhaps it's better if they must love. He frowned.
Do you think so? I don't.
I spoke without considering. It doesn't matter for you. You can marry anyone.
And you cannot?
I blushed, furious with myself for almost giving the curse away. I suppose I can, I muttered. We're both too young to marry in any case.
Are we?
He grinned.
I'm older than you are.
I am then, I said defiantly. And the fairy's gift was horrid. I would hate to have to love someone.
I agree. Love shouldn't be dictated.
Nothing should be dictated. An idiotic remark to a future king, but I was thinking of Lucinda. He answered seriously, As little as possible. When the orchestra finished, we sat together on the bench and watched the sky darken slowly. Sometimes we talked, and sometimes we were silent. He told me more about hunting for ogres. Then he said he was leaving again in 2 days to spend a year in the court of Ayortha. A year? I knew that the future rulers of Ayortha and Kyria always spent long periods in each other's courts. The practice had preserved peace for 200 years. But why now? He smiled at my dismay.
Father says it's time. I'll write to you. You shall know all my doings. Will you write to me in return?
Yes, but I'll have no doings, or few. I shall invent, and you'll have to decide what's real. The noise of horses and carriage wheels reached us from below, signifying the end of the celebration. I went to a window and looked down. Father and Mum Olga were saying farewell to their guests while Hattie and Olive stood by. Lucinda was at Mum Olga's side. The fairy's still here, I said, standing at the bride's side. Char joined me.
Perhaps she means to monitor the effects of her gift.
Would she? Do you think so?
I don't know.
He saw my face.
I can tell her to go. She would hardly like a prince for an enemy.
Don't! A prince would trouble Lucinda not a whit, and a squirrel prince would trouble her even less. Let's just watch. After several more guests departed, Lucinda kissed Father and Mum Olga on the forehead. Then she raised her arms and lifted her head to the twilight sky. For a terrifying moment, I thought she saw me. But no, she just smiled her dazzling smile and vanished. Char gasped. I sighed, a long release. We'd better go down, I said. Soon they'll look for me in earnest. There was just enough light to see by. In a few minutes, we stood on the landing above the hall.
No one is here, Char said. You need resist temptation no longer.
Only if you slide too.
I'll go first, so I can catch you at the bottom.
He flew down so incautiously that I suspected him of years of practice in his own castle. It was my turn. The ride was a dream, longer and steeper than the rail at home. The hall rose to meet me, and Char was there. He caught me and spun me around.
Again, he cried.
We raced up. Behind me, he said,
Wait till you try the banister at home.
His home? When would I do that?
Here I go!
He was off. I followed. I was almost to the bottom when the door opened. I sailed into Char's arms, observed by the stunned faces of Father and my new family. Char couldn't see them and twirled me as before, until he got halfway round. Then he set me gently on the floor and bowed at Father and Mum Olga, his buttonless doublet flapping. He was laughing so hard he couldn't speak. Father grinned. Mum Olga smiled uncertainly. Olive wore her puzzled frown.
Hattie glowered. I used their distraction to conceal the glass slippers in the folds of my skirt.
"Thank you for the honor of your presence," Father said, giving Char time to collect himself.
But not time enough.
"You have," burst of laughter, "my best wishes for your felicity," laughter, "which is assured," peals of laughter. "Forgive me, I'm not laughing," laughter, "at you, please understand," he trailed off.
Father chuckled. I laughed helplessly, holding the stair rail for support. I couldn't help it, although I knew Hattie would make me pay.
Chapter 22. After a final awkward bow, Char left us.
"You've made another conquest, Ella," Father said.
"The prince wouldn't," Hattie began. I interrupted. "I haven't made any conquests. Your mushrooms made the other one. Besides, soon the prince leaves to spend a year in Ayortha."
"My darling, must we remain in this draughty hall?"
Mum Olga extended her lower lip in an absurd pout.
"Sweetness, you're cold? We'll go at once."
Father draped his cloak over Mum Olga's shoulders. In the coach, I was wedged between Hattie and Olive, uncomfortable, but warmed by their bulk. Across from me, Mum Olga turned eagerly to Father.
"Before it would have been wrong to ask, but now I may, dearest. How rich are we?"
"Why, just as rich as we were before. Silly goose, did you think weddings caused our coffers to grow?"
He put his arm around her shoulder.
"No, dear," she pouted again. "I only wanted to know."
"Now you do."
"I may be just a silly goose, but I don't know. I mean, I know how much I have, but I don't know what we have."
Father faced her and put both hands on her shoulders.
"My love, you must be brave."
I braced myself.
"I came to you a poor man, with only myself to offer. I hoped it would be enough.